So, to continue this morning with this contemplation we began yesterday, and really looking at the extended family of mindfulness, of sati, and being very aware that it is the ways in which mindfulness is interfacing with this extended family that really distinguishes mindfulness from attention regulation. Okay? But it's also true to say that I would suggest that mindfulness alone is not enough. Mindfulness needs to be cooperating with this extended family. The great passion of the Buddha's teaching life and his own practice life was in really understanding the ways to bring dukkha to an end. He said, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and there is the end of dukkha, and that dukkha is to be understood. As he was committed to finding the ways to bring dukkha to an end, to understanding it, his equal concern that lives alongside of this was the finding the ways and exploring the ways for people to really grow into the potential they have to be creative, responsive, wise, compassionate human beings, engaging with the world in ways actually that makes a difference. Now, often when the Buddha would speak about dukkha, and I will go into the sort of unpacking of dukkha a little bit later on, when you look at the early texts, he's often placing it in the context of being in an argument. He's often talking about the ways to bring the argument to an end. And he said the argument is a manifestation of not understanding things the way they actually are. Now, you hear this phrase so much in the teaching, the way things actually are. And it sounds like a sort of kind of statement of ideology or something. But the way that the Buddha proposed the way things actually are is that they are changing. They are impermanent. They are unsatisfactory in the sense that they're unable, the world of conditions is unable to provide a reliable sense of safety or enduring happiness. And that they are not self. They are non-self. And when we look at the arguments, many of the arguments that we find ourselves in with life, this is basically what we're arguing with. You know, we don't like change often, except when it benefits us. You know, even though we actually intellectually obviously don't dispute this, it's not an understanding that we always embody. We actually are often in argument with dukkha. You know, we keep looking for ways to find, you know, lasting safety and security, and, you know, looking outwardly for the sources of happiness and joy. And we have a lot of argument with non-self. You know, in reality, but I think psychologically, we're often wearing the T-shirt that says, it really is all about me. And this is the argument, and we often hear the argument in our narratives. Things should be different than they are. Life should be different than it is. You should be different than you are. I should be different than I am. This shouldn't be happening. Or sometimes life is unfair. Or sometimes we hear the argument just in our emotional responses of resistance or judgment or blame. So the Buddha said, you know, so much teaching us to actually, you know, as long as we're in this state of argument, we're actually caught within a world of distress and struggle. And as long as we're caught in this argument, we're also contributing to that world of distress and struggle. So much of the Buddha's teaching is about congruence. It's about embodied understanding. It's about embodied understanding, to really live in the light of what we know, to learn how to step out of the arguments. The quite extraordinary thing is that, you know, we obviously all experience dukkha in our life. Is anybody exempt? Don't think so. We all encounter times of dukkha. We encounter times of joy and loveliness and appreciation and care, but we all encounter moments of dukkha. And yet, isn't it phenomenal that we can actually find ourselves over and over again in cycles of distress making and not learn anything from it? It is possible to suffer without learning anything from it. Which is why the Buddha very much clearly said, you know, dukkha is something that is created and recreated. And the way or that it is recreated is because of the absence of learning or the absence of understanding. Which is why the second factor or the second support of awakening is that of investigation. Investigation of the dhammas, it's often referred to. But really means an investigation of life. An investigation of our world and how our world is being shaped and formed moment to moment. And it's often referred to, this quality of investigation, as being one of the most important supports of awakening. Because this is really about learning to put the arguments down. It's learning to change our views. It's learning to step out of distress. It's learning, actually, to embody insight. Now, investigation is not thinking. It is why investigation is looking backwards to mindfulness. So it's not just about thinking about things. We've done quite a lot of that in our life. And it has great values, and it also has limitations. There is an element of investigation which doesn't very much involve the cognitive process, to reflect upon the teaching. The Buddha encouraged us so much. Reflect upon the teaching. Reflect upon it so you begin to digest it, you begin to assimilate it, you begin to absorb it, you're able to question it, to reflect upon what does this actually mean for me. There's an aspect of investigation which is actually far more experiential. I actually feel that most formal meditation practice, if undertaken skillfully, is experiential investigation. I mean, there are a lot of ways of undertaking meditation practice unskillfully, by the way. But undertaking meditative practice skillfully is a form of investigation because it is always concerned with actually a little bit going past the boundaries of what is familiar and known to us. Always concerned with that. You know, you sit with an aching knee and you see the very familiar impulse to flee and to run, and you have that commitment to actually see what happens if I actually investigate this, go into this, go past that flinch moment. You know, a lot changes in that. You know, the view of, you know, I am my knee begins to change. The habitual response of aversion in the face of the unpleasant begins to change. The capacity for befriending starts to come into view. You know, if you're sitting or walking or living and you see a very familiar pattern perhaps of rumination or obsession or judgment begin to arise, and you really realize you have the choice of what you attend to and how. And rather jumping right in a habitual way, you actually say, actually, this is really a good moment to establish mindfulness in the body. It's actually challenging the habit patterns. It's challenging those patterns that can feel so impulsive and compulsive to actually see what opens up when I actually don't engage in those familiar habit patterns. So investigation is very much experiential, of just going past those boundaries of what we know. There's another aspect to it in terms of meditative development. As we cultivate our capacities for calming, for stilling, for sensitivity, it actually begins to open up new horizons for us. And some of the new horizons it opens up for us is around the views that we hold about ourselves. We often go through life with our self-view held up like a banner. You know, I'm this kind of person. This is what's possible for me. This is what's impossible for me. But as you begin to deepen meditatively, actually many of those views are really questioned. I'm not always agitated. I'm not always anxious. I'm not always aversive. I start to touch upon the capacities of the mind for quite profound care, sensitivity, compassion, balance, and views are upended. All of this is within the realm of experiential investigation. We begin to see experientially in the light of mindfulness what leads to distress and what leads to the end of distress. And we see how our minds and lives change when there is really a ground of stillness and calm. A lot of this is actually very intentional. I feel many people suffer from, in their practice, from overgeneralized intentionality. Yeah? I'm just going to be mindful. Well, good luck. But it doesn't necessarily engage us. And I think there's a part of investigation which is really engaging with a far greater sense of specificity of intentionality. I think this opens up many, many more doors for us. You know, you commit yourself to a month of actually really being mindful of what is skillful speech, what is unskillful speech. You commit yourself for a whole month to really being aware of the shifting from contractedness to opening. You know, you commit yourself for a month to really perhaps challenging a habit of, you know, to perhaps seeing what it is like to cultivate metta in the midst of every moment of aversion arising. And I think the specificity of intentionality actually brings investigation to life. You might experiment with a whole month of actually exploring the landscape of clinging and the landscape of non-clinging. To actually the sense of generosity or the sense of withholding. Investigation really, as much as anything else in this path, I think really requires a sense of commitment and care if it's going to really open up new doorways for us. So investigation is not just something that happens on a meditation cushion. It's actually about how we're living and how we're engaging and how our world is being shaped moment to moment. But if the intentionality is too broad, too generalized, I think it's in danger of becoming incredibly vague. I mean, it's a fine intention, you know, just to be mindful all the time. But I'm not convinced that it actually furthers that level of deepening and understanding and unpacking many of the views and the habit patterns that can so govern us. So investigation has a certain, it has a vitality to it. It has a sense of direction. It has a sense of probing beneath the surface of things. Now, the second aspect of investigation is actually linking our direct experience with the teachings of liberation. And this is where the Buddha says, you know, seeing things the way they actually are, living in the light of our understanding of change, of dukkha, and of unsatisfactoriness. This is, you know, the Buddha once said that the understanding of impermanence, the lived understanding of impermanence, is the most transforming of all insights. And you think now, why would he say that? Because it kind of makes a mockery of clinging. That's simple. It makes something of a mockery of grasping, of identification, the mechanisms we use to make things stand still. If we want to turn process into state, just throw in a bit of clinging. If we want to turn verbs into nouns, just throw in a bit of clinging. If we want to really create and recreate distress, just throw in a bit of clinging. Is anybody happy in moments of grasping? It's, you know, kind of a core lesson. You know, what's the felt nature of that experience? It's one of contractedness, it's one of being boundaried, it's often one of anxiety, of fear of loss. I think it's very hard to find happiness in moments of clinging. And yet this is the argument that we are having with change. It's a felt argument that we're having with change. This is how I will make things stay the same or be reliable or stand still or be more, or have more certainty, is actually to try and take hold of things. It's a huge dimension of investigation in our lives. You know, because, the Buddhist teaching is very process-centered. You know, worlds are being shaped. There's a process of selfing. There's a process of minding. We could even say there's a process of bodying. The world is something that is fluid, unfolding, dynamic. And actually to align ourselves with that fluidity is to find the deepest peace. And yet that is actually often what we are having an argument with, because it feels more groundless. And it is groundless. And groundlessness to the in the light of the absence of awareness feels fearful. In the light of understanding, it feels deeply peaceful. So what is really important, I think, just to mention, is that insights are not something we have. Insights are something we practice. Insights are something we embody. And I think there is no shortage of moments in our life to actually practice and embody our understanding, our intellectual understanding of impermanence. We just need to keep an eye on all of those moments of contracting, of closing, of defending, of arguing, and actually to really ask the wisdom question, what is going on here? How much are we actually in this state of argument, which sets us apart from the rhythms of life? Does that make sense to you? This is not news to anybody. I mean, I think the great genius of the Buddha's teaching, he didn't talk about things we don't already know. You know, nobody starts sitting and hears about impermanence for the first time in their lives. We know this. We know this. It's something else, isn't it, to really live it. It's no accident or coincidence, I think, that impermanence is actually, in most presentations, placed as the first of the three characteristics. Because I think it's that very core argument that we put down that really allows us to really begin to investigate dukkha. Now, dukkha is so terribly badly translated as suffering, which is, I think it's one of those words in Pali that you're better off just keeping the Pali version rather than trying to find an English translation. Because as far as the Buddha is concerned, dukkha permeates everything that's lovely as well as everything that's difficult. You know, it's not just about distress. It's about unreliability. You know, the chronic instability of life. So, I don't know how much of this you know, but I'll go through it anyway. I mean, dukkha has three translations, three dimensions. The first of these is dukkha-dukkha. You familiar with that one? Double dukkha. And this simply, refers to being a human being. You know, we have bodies that hurt. That sometimes life just hurts. You know, loss hurts. Bodies age. Bodies get sick. You know, bodies die. this whole range of emotions that, you know, of conditions in life that simply just hurt. And when the Buddha teaches, you know, the end of dukkha, he's not teaching immortality. He's actually teaching us to make peace with dukkha-dukkha. The different dimensions of dukkha ask for different responses. The first two dimensions of dukkha ask for compassion, for grace, for understanding. The third dimension of dukkha that I'll talk about asks for ending. So dukkha-dukkha, this is what joins us together in a human family. This is not all about me. This is what it means to be a human being, is sometimes to hurt. And that can be responded to with all kinds of argument, can't it? You know, with aversion and fear and anxiety and it shouldn't be happening and, you know, I should have an exemption. It's okay if it happens to everybody else, but I somehow should have an exemption. You know, the average age of most people's first chronic illness is 45. You know, the average age when you look in a mirror and see your mother, father staring back at you is 32. You know, this is what it means to be a human being, is that we're not actually exempt. And this asks often for so much, a kind of radical shift, doesn't it, of care, of compassion, of equanimity, of balance, of understanding. But it so much asks for the end of the argument. The second dimension of dukkha is viparinami dukkha. And viparinami dukkha really, again, refers to life, the changing nature of conditions that we cannot always control. You know, we cannot get up tomorrow morning and decide it's going to be sunny. You know, we cannot decide that, you know, our children are going to be well and thrive. You know, we cannot decide that the world is going to stand still for us. We can't decide that our car is going to start in the morning. You know, all of this world of conditions that is so fluid and changeable and outside of our control and unstable and unreliable, it is just the way it is. It is just the way. It doesn't mean that we're helpless, because we are part of that world of conditions and we contribute to that world of conditions. And we can contribute in very, you know, skillful and wise ways. And we can also contribute with a whole lot of argument. And we see how much mechanisms of control appear in our life to endeavor to manipulate the world of conditions. So basically I have the conditions I want and I don't have the conditions I don't want. You know, I have the pleasant conditions and I don't have the unpleasant conditions. And this actually is what keeps us so busy for so much of our days, isn't it? It's just the little ones, you know. Oh, you know, a little bit too cold, I'll fix that. A little bit too warm, I'll fix that. You know, don't quite like that on the menu. I have this on the menu. You know, my cushion's lumpy. You know, the endless endeavors we are making to control and manipulate the world of conditions, it keeps us agitated. It doesn't mean that we step back into a life of passivity and disengagement. Because we are asked to engage with this world of conditions as compassionately and as skillfully as we are able to do. But it means recognizing always there are limits to our power to control and to manipulate. And there can be, you know, you can find a tremendous grace in this, which is certainly not present in the argument. It's not present in the argument. So these first two domains of dukkha, they ask for skillfulness, they ask for compassion, they ask for understanding, they ask for us to put down the argument with them. It's the third domain of dukkha that the Buddha's teaching of awakening and liberation is really concerned with. And this is called sankhata or sankhara dukkha. You familiar with this? the world, the dukkha of patterning. The dukkha of patterning. The ways that the first two domains of dukkha are compounded through the patterns of reactivity that we bring to them. The aversion that is brought to the unpleasant, the denial that is brought to loss, the craving that is brought to the pleasant. You know, the patterns of reactivity, the patterns of selfing in relationship to the first two domains of dukkha, the way that we personalize them. What does this say about me? What does this say about who I am? So this sankhata dukkha is actually the ways in which the first two domains of dukkha are actually argued with, through aversion, through craving, through fear, through selfing. And this is the dukkha that Buddha says can come to an end. Now, part of that sankhata dukkha, of course, is the domain of selfing, the way that the world is personalized through the mechanisms of clinging, which actually create the self of the moment. So the third of these characteristics is the understanding of non-self. So I hope you can see in sankhata dukkha, this is a process through which views of self are built. This is a process through which views of self are constructed. I am like this because this is happening to me, because I am being defined by the contents of experience in this moment. The body's ill, I'm sick, I'm afraid. There's difficulties in our family, maybe I'm not a good parent, or I'm not a good partner. So sankhata dukkha, a major part of sankhata dukkha, is actually the building of self. Sankhata is an interesting word in Pali because it means anything that is formed. Anything that is formed. So in a way, this microphone is a sankhara or a sankhata. But the way it's used in this context is through the emotional and psychological patterning that is born of misunderstanding that forms and constructs a self of the moment and a world of the moment. So the third of the characteristics that the Buddha stressed so highly that we are asked to understand, really understand, is this notion of self and non-self. And please be aware, the Buddha did not teach no self. That is a toxic translation that is actually dangerous. It means no ethical implications, no relational implications. But he did teach the emptiness of self in all things. That self is a construction. It is a formation. It is a solidifying. It is a reification. He actually said a lot of things about this. He says the notion of self is an irritation. It's a vexation. It's a creation. And above all, it is dukkha. Above all, it is dukkha. This is such a hard one. I think intellectually we have agreement with impermanence, and we can have a lot of agreement with our inability to fully control the world of conditions, but this is where we really have a lot of argument. And we can see it in our lives, can't it? The I and the other, the self and the other, the contractedness of that. And as far as the Buddha was concerned, the understanding of non-self is not the graduate school of wisdom, it's the kindergarten. And I think he expressed many moments in his teaching life why he was so puzzled why people found it hard to actually get this. Because he says, just look at your own experience. He says, look at your own experience. How many selves have you been today? I was happy at breakfast, and I was a little depressed when my egg was too hard, and then I was pretty, eager to get out of the house and get going, and then I wasn't too sure I should be here, maybe I should be off hiking, my pelvic floor, my hip bones are all aching, you know, I'm getting, you know, I'm really not up for this anymore. How many selves have you been today? The Buddha says, just, you know, this too is impermanent. This too is process. This too is an unfolding story. He didn't talk about erasing the self. He talked about ending clinging to views of self. He says, this is the dukkha, is clinging to views of self. Some of these are very changeable. Some of these views of self we have inherited from others. Some of them are family traditions. Some of them are very fleeting. Some of them are very historical. But they are all fabrications. So there's a bit of a concern with this, like, what actually contributes to dukkha? And he said, it is the clinging to views of self. And this is something to be understood and investigated in the light of our own moment-to-moment experience. I mean, it's so interesting, because I think one of the fears or anxieties that often arises for people is, you know, oh, I'm going to be no one, please. You're not going to be no one. You think the Buddha was no one. You know, he was a pretty functional human being, as far as I could see. You know, he moved through life, creative, you know, engaged, wise, you know, created great legacies. He wasn't a no one. But there was no clinging to views of self. In fact, you know, there's a discourse where the Buddha really speaks about cultivating identities that lead to the flourishing and thriving of the wholesome, and not cultivating identities that lead to the thriving and the flourishing of the unwholesome. So he's actually addressing, you know, how do we live in this world? We're asked to find a way to be, to an identity that is useful, that is of service, that is functional, that is creative. But it can be empty of views of self. It can be empty of views of self. So the encouragement of the Buddha was, continue to investigate this. Just look at this, investigate this. Look at it in your own experience. What do you see in views of self that actually stand still? What do views of self do to actually, how does it impact your life? You know, and in terms of Buddhist psychology, there's a continuum process that happens here, which I referred to somewhat yesterday. That craving and aversion, when they intensify, they turn into clinging and grasping. When clinging and grasping intensifies, it turns into views of self. Okay? So there's a continuum that the view of self does not arise out of a vacuum. It has its roots deeply embedded in the craving and aversion process. When not seen, when unattended to, tends to intensify into contractedness and holding. Holding, actually, when that intensifies, is the birthplace of the I am. It's a very simple process to track. You know, this is not beyond anyone. But it is important to see it as to see the views of self as being part of a continuum, rather than something independent, standalone that popped up out of nowhere. It didn't pop up out of nowhere. It is this continuum. Okay. This is something we can investigate. It's something we can track, it's something we can trace in our own experience. And this is not about sort of annihilation or erasure. It is actually really appreciating and enjoying the liberation of non-self. I would also suggest you have many of these moments in your day. Please don't think of this as being something inaccessible or mysterious. There's a lot of moments of non-selfing in everybody's day. Have you ever brushed your teeth without being the brusher? You know? You ever, you know, encountered those unhesitating moments of care and sensitivity and generosity? You know, have you ever sat in meditation and breathed without there being the breather? When the breathing is just breathing itself? There are many, many moments of non-selfing in a single day. We tend to overlook them. because we are so actually focused, or our attention is drawn to the painfulness of the moments of selfing, that we actually don't always appreciate all of those moments of non-selfing. So self is a process. There's a process of selfing that arises and passes. It is dependent upon conditions, and it falls away with other conditions. And there are many moments when that is not arising, okay, when there is no view of self. You know, from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, you know, this is a circular process. It's not a one-way street, because when a view of self is born in the roots of craving and aversion, that view of selfing often goes back, circles round to solidify the craving and aversion. You know, Sally Joe again, you know. Sally Joe's coming in late again, you know, and, you know, I don't like it, you know, I really don't like it, and I really, really don't like it, and she's doing it again, you know, and I can feel the aversion gathering, you know, I can feel the clinging to it as my attention gathers around it, and, you know, I'd never do that. And I'm a much more respectful person than that. I would never do that. Well, next time Sally Jo is coming through the door, I don't even need to see her. I just need to hear the sound of the door. And the aversion is already, that selfing is feeding back into the aversion. But notice that self and other are simultaneous arisings. Selfing doesn't occur in a vacuum. The creation of selfing is a creation of othering in the same moment, and this is something that is prevalent through every strata of our society. And the result is suffering. You know. Okay, we have a pause moment. Any reflections, any questions on this bit at all? Makes sense to you? Does it make sense? Yeah. Feeling of being offended. Well, it's one of the one reaction in the range of our reactions, isn't it? That is much to do with I am offended, because the world is not as it should be. I'm in the argument.
Because that brings the I out really big.
Yep. Well, people have their different favorite nesting places of selfing, you know. For some people, it's in being offended, you know. For another person, it can be somewhere else. It's quite useful, actually, to become mindful of the kind of sankharas that tend to get triggered, that are so implicated in the self-building.
Understand better the difference between wholesome identities and the selfing that's not.
What's the difference between wholesome identities and the selfing? Wholesome identities you inhabit when they're appropriate. Okay, if I go shopping and I'm inhabiting the identity of a Dharma teacher every moment of my life, it's really wearisome. To the person behind the register in the supermarket, you know, or to my grandson, you know. Wholesome identities are basically rooted in ethics. That's a big piece. They're ethical, but they're also appropriate to the moment. They're appropriate to the moment. You know, if you're a teacher or a parent or, you know, whatever identity is present in your life that is, you know, wholesome, rooted in ethics, contributes to well-being, it is something you put on and put down. Whereas self-view tends to be far more static. Wholesome identities don't hold dukkha within them. They don't hold dukkha within them. They're fluid responsiveness. You know, and they're creative. You know, you might hold the wholesome identity of being an artist, or, you know, a parent, or, you know, a partner, or, you know, a profession that is, you know, wholesome and ethical, and it doesn't hold dukkha within it. And also, you know, it doesn't build a lot of narratives. Whereas, you know, one of the real characteristics of views of self is the amount of proliferation that it generates. You know, how do I keep this view of self in place? How do I legitimize it? How do I protect it? How do I defend it? You know, how do I view others? But wholesome identities are very, you know, because, you know, to not teach people to be dysfunctional, you recognize people live in this world, you know, and living in this world means choosing directions, having aspirations, having values, you know, having ethics, making choices, and all of that involves, to some extent, identity. But it doesn't involve necessarily dukkha. Then it's fluid. So fluidity, non-narrative generating, absence of dukkha. Good clues to wholesome identities. Yes, please. The temptation to argue. Right. The pleasure in art found in the initial argument before the proliferation comes back to haunt you. This is probably a temptation it's really good to be very mindful of. Because actually you know where it goes. I mean, that's the interesting thing, you know. Often when the Buddha's reflecting on skillful effort, he says, you know, one of the things you should reflect on is what is the outcome here? You know, and in a sense, you know, it is somehow that addictive quality to sankharas. You know, the initial kind of thrill of getting into an argument before it really starts to suffer. Huh? But we know where it goes, you know, and so maybe that's the point where mindfulness actually really can be a great ally. I don't need to do this. Yeah, I actually don't need to do this. I have the choice to actually, in that moment, bring that particular pattern to an end. That's the process of fasting. It's very hard to explain some of the delight that we take in patterns that really don't serve us well. Yeah. I mean, some of those patterns are often woven into views of self. You know, this is how I get to be self-righteous, or it's how I get to sort of be somehow superior, or, you know, get to win. You know, but I think, you know, we could go around that circle for a long time, and I think experientially it's sometimes really realizing if you've got a moment of choice to step out of a pattern, take it. You know the outcome of not doing it. Yeah.
The political situation in our world at the moment is more than agitating. So I can march, I can sign petitions, I can go around in circles till I'm exhausted. How to come to terms with those sorts of things in a realistic way?
I'm not quite sure coming to terms with it is the phrase that I would want to use. I mean, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, the Buddha was so engaged with changing the shape of his world and not just changing the shape of people's minds. And, you know, part of discernment is really recognizing that learning to develop deep levels of equanimity and stillness and balance does not mean that everything in the world is acceptable. There is much that's unacceptable in that it leads to suffering. Finding the appropriate response is an ongoing journey in my mind. And I mean, it's certainly the appropriate response is not resignation. And that's why I find it, you know, sometimes we have to hold the long view. You know, particularly when everything feels critical or, you know, you know, beyond imagining, it's really important to hold the long view. This too is actually going to change, and we need to contribute to that change. It's not going to change because we consent to it. We need to contribute to that change, but at the same time, to rescue our own minds from despair, we actually have to hold the long view, and sometimes to know really what it is to find a refuge inwardly, you know, amongst those conditions that you simply cannot control, but you're not entirely helpless before. And that's you know, a lot of that is actually the teaching of equanimity, actually, which is one of the awakening factors. It's finding that very fine line of knowing that we cannot control the ways that another person's mind moves. Even when we love them deeply, we know that people who love us deeply can't control or change the ways of our mind, that's in our hands. But it doesn't make us helpless, because we contribute as much as we can to supporting those changes. There's no easy answers here. But, you know, I think we take lessons of knowing that to succumb to despair or rage or resignation is certainly adding to the mountain of dukkha. There's other things that we can contribute. I mean, we really need to be very mindful of it. The question is around in those kind of situations where, you know, you're up against something that's very unacceptable, how the sense of self and other becomes really inflamed. And we need to be so careful with that, because, you know, it's within that paradigm of the self and other that hatred lives, that blame lives, that shame lives, that aggression lives, that fear lives. You know, we need to be actually so careful of that. It's not, you know, don't be unrealistic and say, well, this should never arise. Okay, it's arisen, you know. It's arisen. I really see this sense of inflammation. Inflammation's a really good word. I see this inflammation of the selfing growing in tandem with the inflammation of the othering. And really, we need to be so sensitive, I feel, that is the doorway to hell. You know, that is the doorway to immense suffering. And, you know, we really need to sense, you know, that... So, you know, this path doesn't flourish in the world of ideal conditions and lovely people and perfect environments. It flourishes actually in the midst of this. I mean, this has always been the teachings of compassion. It's always been the teachings of wisdom. You know, that it's in the midst of that's actually where we dig deep in terms of finding what is possible for us. Okay, the self and the othering is inflamed. What comes next? You know, do I feed that? Do I feed that with ill will? Do I feed that with judgment? Do I feed that with guilt or blame or shame? Or is there something else that happens in the awareness of that selfing and othering that can happen? You know, the most difficult domain of compassion is actually to find compassion for those who perpetrate suffering. And yet that's what we're asked to do. And that's what we're asked to do. And that's not, and there's nothing kind of like sentimental about that. That's really a wisdom practice. But it's really knowing, I think, that, you know, having the, you know, the mindfulness to accept, you know, okay, this is arisening. Am I going to feed it? Am I going to fast it? You know, I remember that when the Brexit vote came in England, you know, we sort of made an agreement in our house, we were not going to speak of this for 3 days. Because it would have been just so easy just to jump into the whole proliferation and outrage and all the rest of it. We're not going to speak of it for 3 days. It's not that we're not going to consider it or think about it, but we're not just going to inflame it, okay? And I think that word inflame is really beautiful. Because what do you do with an inflammation? You cool it. You cool it. You find the ways to cool it. And there's a lot of ways that we can find to cool inflammation. And it's very easy to further the inflammation. But well, I think we also see that furthering the inflammation actually is really, to some extent, I think, is what paralyzes skillful response. Which is perhaps even more important to consider. Yes, please.
It's going back to yesterday, but I was quite struck when you talked about defended awareness and protective awareness. And I'm just, I got it energetically, but then when I go into my brain and try to articulate it, I'm just wondering if you could explain.
What I said was that protective awareness is not defensive awareness. Okay.
Right, but in my mind, they're very closely linked, and I'm just wondering if you could.
Well, because we can fool ourselves a little bit and say, well, you know, I'm actually protecting the well-being of my mind, but it's because I'm actually averse to something. You know, there's something I don't want. So it is a fine line. It is a fine line. Protective awareness, what's the difference between a protective awareness and defensive awareness? The absence or presence of aversion? Probably. But I think you need to treat that fine line as an investigation. Protective awareness does not become a position. It's an appropriate response to the moment. Whereas what we might, the near enemy of that, of being defensive, actually becomes a position of pushing away. So it is a fine line, and it is one to really investigate. Yesterday, I'm going to repeat the questions because I don't know if you can hear them. Yesterday I mentioned that the biggest shift that I ever see people make in meditative practice, and actually the biggest shift that people make in contemporary-based mindfulness applications, is actually the shift from aversion to befriending. What insights are involved in making that shift? There are so many. Beginning to appreciate the dukkha of aversion is a big one. But it's also a sense of capacity, developing the resilience and the capacity to be with discomfort rather than to flee is huge, because that's the beginning of being able to be curious, to be able to investigate, to be able to befriend. And this is, quite frankly, a trained capacity to be with discomfort rather than the automatic flight from discomfort. You know, and if you ever meet someone or yourself lives with chronic pain or illness, you know how challenging that is to actually be, to turn towards discomfort rather than to turn away. But this is one of the teachings of mindfulness, is actually we turn towards what is. And actually that's the first point that opens the possibility of actually beginning to be curious, to investigate, to take the self out, to befriend, to allow. I mean, it's just one of the sort of core pieces of mindfulness practice. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but much of this teaching is.
Changing befriending to aversion, I always kind of thought that similar contact produced similar feelings. So when there's contact in the past, feelings, perceptions, formations, and a consciousness arises. But then this morning I noticed when that horn went, the first thing that arose was a little bit of aversion, because, well, that's annoying. And then there was compassion, like, I feel sorry for that person. I hope they have a good round of sitting and don't think that they're disturbing us. But then the second time it went, there wasn't even a feeling. It was just oh, I better get back to the practice. It was kind of like a call to action. And then the third time it went, there wasn't even that thought. There was just, where was I? Where am I? Stay embodied here. So I think I'm kind of answering my own question. I'm not sure. So if we take out the selfing or the self-view that arises between contact and feeling and replace it with, I think I just answered, replace it with mindfulness, then that feeling is not, we can change the habit patterns of those feelings from past contacts. That's the question.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, did you hear the question? It was about the questioning the assumption that the feeling tone of something always stays the same. You know, listening to the sound in the city this morning, first response, first feeling tone being some annoyance, second feeling tone, you know, second response being, oh, you know, task-oriented, come back to the body. Third response to the sound and the feeling tone of the sound was actually just much simpler. So, I mean, there's more and more research done now in Western psychology in understanding this critical point of Vedana, or feeling tone of experience, that this is a launch pad for constructing our world. But Vedana tones do not stay the same, because how we feel about something is influenced by so many factors that are present in the moment. Presence or absence of mindfulness, what mood is present. You know, you could be sitting with a mood of impatience and I ring the bell, it's a pleasant feeling tone. You know, you could be sitting with a place of great stillness, I ring the bell, it's an unpleasant feeling tone. So there's nothing static in feeling tone. The unwise mind perceives the feeling tone as being implicit in the object. Because we see the feeling tone being implicit in the object, this is the grounds of craving and aversion. Because this holds the intrinsic power to be pleasant and make me happy, there's a ground for craving. But if I see this as having the intrinsic power to be of being unpleasant and make me unhappy, I have the grounds for aversion. When Vedana tones are unquestioned, they become the birthplace of our world of the moment. And it's really important to see the fluidity of feeling tones, of not being implicit in the object, but being shaped by so many other factors. And that's what gives us choice around our responses to Vedana.
I just had a power moment here that I just thank you, that just, I don't know how I'm going to articulate this, but I feel like this is huge. I want to thank you for yesterday as well. It was just a pretty profound day. I was struggling after the lady at the back asked about, you know, what do you do with all this agitation? And I didn't want to talk about this weekend, but the Kavanaugh situation.
We're not going to get into specific stories right now, okay?
Thank you. What just came up for me when this gentleman shared was that the sound just felt like a color to me, and I hadn't thought about that. And I was like, was that yesterday I heard a sound? And it was just like a color and a shape. And I don't know when it came or when it lasted, but the recent situation has been very difficult for me. And so I sat with that. And then it became clear that it's difficult to sit with powerlessness in my body. And that I've had lots of stories around all of that. And I work at, I'm a therapist, and all of my female clients have been going through hell. And I can identify with that. And then I had someone come into a session the other day, a woman who wanted me to help her because she really did not like Christine Blasey Ford, and was really relieved that, you know, things turned out. And that was really hard, but it really helped me go back. And then when you said about the bell, it just hit. It's not
him. it's not being able to sit
with powerlessness.
Yeah, because with this woman who liked what happened, it's all about powerlessness as well. So it was like, bing, it's not out there. I just got that.
Yeah.
And the sound was easy. You know, it was color, it was kind of pleasant, it was a rubbery, it was like, oh, mm. But what is that Kavanaugh thing about?
And yeah.
It's like, oh. So it just feels like there's like nothing now. So I don't even know what to do with that. Because it's been defining me for as long as, you know, all this has been happening.
Well, it's a big insight.
Yes, I would say.
It's a big insight, you know. And it's actually, it's so kind of a relief moment.
Oh, you have no idea.
The Buddha talks about finding joy in seeing the difficult fall away.
Mm, I'm feeling it. That's a big one. That bell will stay with me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you ready for a shift in posture? I have ambitions. I don't want to leave you halfway through the awakening practice at the end of the day. I have ambitions, so, but they're realizable. That's great. So I'd like to suggest that we actually have a walking period, and that when we come back, we actually move on to this next supportive awakening.